Welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this conversation, I talk with Lucy. Lucy is a transracial adoptee and contacted us following our Wednesday webcasts, and she wanted to share her story. Lucy tells us more background into her own experience, being born in Hong Kong and adopted, subsequently raised by white British parents. Lucy also tells us about her experience of racism and identity, as well as being one member of a group of transracial foundlings from Hong Kong. With the other foundlings, she took part in a group run by the British Association of Adoption and Fostering, BAF, now Coram BAF. We hope you enjoy the conversation, and if you have a story you'd like to share, then why not drop us a line on any of our social media channels? And while you're here, if you could, leave us a review on the podcast app. We would really appreciate it.
My name is Lucy Sheen. I am a transracial adoptee, late 50s, early 60s. I am now a professional actor, writer, filmmaker, and activist, which is a funky way of saying I guess I'm a troublemaker.
Well, we're all activists in our own ways. I guess it just depends on the level. So, and you came, you contacted us after our very recent, the Wednesday webcast, and also we were talking about transracial adoption and stuff like that, and you came forward.
That's right.
So you obviously feel that it's something that you want to share. So, do you mind me asking where this all starts from? Like, you know, I don't know your background, so it's a really kind of, basic kind of start from the beginning job.
Mm-hmm. I suppose in terms of being interested, aware, understanding my background, that came incredibly late on in life. So I was contacted back in 2008 by the then British Association of Adopters and Fosterers. They had decided to do a research project on a group of transracial adoptees, Hong Kong foundlings, which came over in the late mid-50s to early 60s. And I'm one of those 106 foundlings that were transracially adopted to ostensibly white English parents in the UK. And it was that, I suppose, that triggered re-triggered my interest in exactly how I came about to be here. And also at the same time, I suppose it triggered my politics, if you like, in terms of transracial adoption. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's something that I've always been aware, having been brought up by an adoptive family that was completely white, English, yeah. Had no connection to East Asia whatsoever, yeah. Had, as far as I'm aware, never been out of the British Isles in the 50s, 60s. Mm. In terms of the language and the understanding we have now about birth culture, you know, sort of native tongues, there was none of that, yeah. At all. You know, sort of the phrase is such cultural displacement that had yet to be sort of coined. So I was this kind of weird foreign thing. It was me and an Indian restaurant, the only two things that were non-white in the place that I spent most of my formative years. So it was quite noticeable. Mm. So fast forward kind of like almost 50 years, when I was approached by BAF, I was interested in taking part in the study because they were trying to ascertain how being transracially adopted during that time had, if anything, affected our lives, how we grew up, what we'd gone on to be and become, etc. And I think the overall riding thing that I took from that is first physically meeting practically all of the 106. I think there were two adoptees who sadly had passed away.
Right.
But I think I met 98 of them.
Wow.
Which was an amazing experience, as well as being incredibly weird. Mm. For the first time, being in a room with everybody looking like me, all talking with different British regional accents, yeah. Which was kind of like amazing, but also bizarre, because you don't really see that. Mm. And realizing that obviously there is, to a certain extent, a connection, but the assumption that, you know, sort of just because we're transracial adoptees, which is a wide thing that I think all adoptees suffer from, whether they're sort of international, transracial or national, mm-hmm. that because you're an adoptee, you somehow know everybody else, which of course you don't.
Yeah.
Each adoptee's experience is unique to them. So that started me thinking about the commonalities that we had, and a lot of the transracial adoptees that I sort of connected with, not just in the UK, but predominantly, I guess, in the States, because the community is bigger, mm. is the theme of actually that loss, trauma, whatever you want to call it, but the challenges that are imposed upon the transracial adoptee. And I'm sure that's the same for same race and national adoptees, mm. actually becomes, I think, greater as you get older, and particularly with transracial adoptees, because it is not that you just lose your biological family, you lose your culture, your language, your heritage, your roots. And it's always very curious that the people that tell you that you shouldn't worry about belonging and, you know, sort of where you fit in, are usually white, middle-class, male, Oxbridge-educated mm. People who have no need to worry about where they come from or where they fit into society, mm. because they are consistently and constantly socially and culturally reaffirmed, whereas transracial adoptees aren't. And during the period that I grew up, which was kind of like the 60s, I mean, the UK was a white country, mm. Secular Christian country. Mm. And being non-white, you definitely stuck out like a sore thumb. I grew up during a period and saw the rise of the National Front, which was actually quite frightening. Mm. Unfortunately, we seem to be seeing a resurgence of those types of views recently. So that was the society that I grew up in, and mm. and actually knowing where you sit, having been raised with all the expectations and privileges of being white, and that's not just about finance or social position, but the normative since the 18th century is very much Western Eurocentric. Whiteness is superior mm-hmm. to other races. Yeah. So that obviously has a direct effect upon the individual transracial adoptee, whether you actually understand that, which I don't think you do. It's not until you get older, when you start hitting the life markers, like leaving home, having your first serious relationship or getting married, having children. I mean, you have none of that. When I was taken into the orphanage in Hong Kong, Kowloon, that's when my life begins. Everything prior to that, everything that I had prior to that is lost.
Yeah.
I know that I probably have quite a lot of relatives running around in Hong Kong that are still alive, that are probably very close relatives, but I wouldn't know them and they wouldn't know me, mm. even if we were to sort of pass on the street or stand directly behind each other in a queue.
Yeah.
So that research, or the the call to be involved in that research is, I guess, where my journey restarted. Mm-hmm. I had actually gone back to Hong Kong in the sort of the mid-70s to late 70s and bottled going to see the orphanage where I had been taken to. I'm not quite sure why. I think it's probably I was fear of finding out that there was nothing to find out, or maybe finding out things that I didn't want to know. And I was quite young at the time, and I don't think, probably with hindsight, that I would have maybe handled that very, very well. I now, having done research and having kind of like connected and joined the dots in terms of where I sit in British society and the challenges that I face, not only being female, not only being over the age of 55, but also transracially adopted. So I am kind of in the middle of all these minority kind of like groupings. And you don't necessarily have a place, and you do have to, I think, first have to come to terms with what it is you are, or in my case, very, very much what it is I am not. And if other people find that difficult to handle, then that truly is their problem. It's not mine. And they have to come to terms with that. I am now comfortable in myself, now in myself, to be able to stand up and sort of say things that probably other people would like to say, but don't have the courage because I'm old enough and ugly enough, and I basically don't care anymore. What, you know, I've reached a certain a stage in my life where, you know, it's not, in some sense, it's going to make any difference. I think it all plays, particularly, I mean, obviously I can't speak for transracial adoptees in the US, particularly Asian American adoptees, because the community there is much bigger, and their route into kind of like mainstream society, as it were, is very different from British East Asians over here, whereas we are kind of like still very much a minority within minorities. But what did kind of spur me to action is that I got persuaded to do a documentary, which was the first time that I would have stepped behind the camera. I wanted to do a documentary about the 106 Hong Kong foundlings and where we were, etc. And then I ran into the politics of adoption, which I'd not, I suppose, naively hadn't really thought about. And it's an interesting minefield. And I came across a lot of what I have now sort of called born-again adoptees, who are people who are, for whatever reason, very evangelical about adoption. And adoption is the best thing since sliced bread. The end justifies the means. And they don't brook any negative criticism about adoption per se. I am not against adoption, but then again, I'm not for it. I think it is an incredibly complex topic. Sadly, I think there will always be a need for some kind of adoption. What I oppose are the systems that have that continue to this day that are I see as particularly antiquated. I don't think that the adoption process and those that work in the adoption business with agencies, it's not child-centric, which it should be. It is more focused on the needs and the desires of the prospective adopting parents. That's kind of a blanket statement. Not all adopted parents are bad, the same as not all people are bad or good. But I think the way that adoption is handled and the things that you have to do or don't have to do are geared for looking after the adoptive parents when, in my mind, that system, adoption, should be for the betterment and the good of the child, not fulfilling a need for parents because they want a child. That may sound quite harsh, but, you know, sort of children, babies, we're not commodities. And when I was transracially adopted, we were very much looked upon as commodities. The language that was used, you know, we were, well, I came over in a shipment, as it were, just before Christmas, and there was a lot of national news coverage, and we were described as the ultimate, you know, sort of oriental Christmas gift, which, you know, we were babies.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't gifts.
No.
But that's how the thinking was. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that thinking hasn't really changed in the same way that adoption is deeply kind of like connected to infertility. Always has been, you know, sort of young women sort of in the 17th, 18th century who had children out of wedlock, they would give them to, you know, sort of doctors, physicians would find, you know, sort of wealthy families who couldn't have children and pass them on. So, you know, they got a name, they got standing, etc. And that has continued. And I think this is something that we... the adoption process needs to relook at. There is also, again, one of the things that got me into being more active in the adoption arena, as it were, is the way that adoptees are pretty well much, even when you're an adult, you're treated as a child, and you're kind of, especially if you have a dissenting view of the forever, you know, sort of family, happily ever after, the fairy tale, you know, sort of ending. And because that doesn't happen for all adoptees, sadly, and it is not the life reaffirming process that it should be. But then we are talking about human beings, and that complexity. And I found pretty much, well, again, on the side of me being a woman of colour, being dismissed when I'm in a room predominantly full of white people, telling me what it is to experience racism. And it's like, you know, that's just kind of like rude.
Yeah.
How, you know, why should you dismiss my lived experience just because you haven't encountered that? And it's, you get a similar thing with adoptees. An awful lot with transracial adoptees, and it takes, I think, a different tack, a far more aggressive tack, maybe because colour is also ingrained within that, within the transracial adoption facet of people telling you what it is to be a transracial adoptee, because they don't believe or they've never come across adoptees who've not had a brilliant experience. And that started to kind of like really annoy me. So I became active in the sense that I've written articles, I've had stuff published in a variety of anthologies looking at experience of transracial adoptees and adoptees and, you know, sort of what that actually means.
Can I ask didn't mean to interrupt you, but I am really interested in the kind of, the experience of racism, if you wouldn't mind me asking, because I think for me, and I'm talking about my own personal thing with this, and I think being gay maybe helps in terms of, you know, I'm different to the normal, like you were saying, the Oxbridge white man who is, you know, comes from a background, he knows, you know, that he's got a wife and two kids and he's potentially heterosexual and all that sort of stuff. So colour to me, it just, you know, I don't even, often don't see it, if that makes sense. I just see a person. How being brought up with in a white family, when did you start to notice that difference? Was it in within the family, or was it outside, or you know, how? Because I just, you know.
So I first formally recognised that when my adopted mother took me into her place of work. She was a school teacher.
Right.
Object for bring and tell, and I was stood on a desk and talked about. I think it was at that point I must have been 4
right.
or maybe slightly younger.
Yeah.
That crystallised what I think I'd always known, but obviously at that age you probably can't express that verbally.
Yeah.
So I was very young. I mean, you know, so if you're talking about the 60s, so
yeah.
Everybody, I got by until I suppose the time that I went to junior school. Particularly as a toddler, as a kid, as being the young, cute, you know, sort of slightly different.
Yeah.
As some people would say, being polite at that time, and then that quickly passes, and you just become like any other kid that's different, has glasses, is slightly overweight. You become the butt of bullying.
Yeah.
Which you know I suffered. Like any other different child that was different, although there was a slight edge to that because of my race, I think, and mainly because at the time, I think a lot of people thought that I was Japanese.
Right.
So that connotation to that, obviously, in terms of the world history, as it were. It was something I was very conscious of and became more and more of a challenge and a problem as I grew up, as I grew to be more independent, more self-aware and wanted answers. And every time I asked, I got punished because it wasn't something, you know, you're talking about the days, you know, an adult told you not to do something you didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, it got to the point where I just didn't ask anymore. I mean, I was told that, you know, sort of nothing was known about my parents, that I was abandoned because my biological parents didn't want me, they didn't care. Mm. And what kind of solidified my desire to be quite active in telling my story for a purpose was that I wasn't aware until I was in my 50s that there was an international social services file kept on my case that I should have access to when I was 18.
Right.
But I was never allowed that access. Mm. I was never told. And when I did go to pick up my ISS file, I was actually quite shocked and then very angry to see the thickness of it. Right. And there were whole sort of passages about what had happened to me, how I had been found, where I'd been found, what I was wearing, my physical condition when I was sort of picked up and taken to the orphanage. I was they advertised for 6 months on Hong Kong radio and newsprint to try and find blood relatives. It wasn't unusual for people not to come forward at that time. Because of what was happening in Hong Kong socially and economically, which is why we all sort of ended up coming over to being adopted by English families over here.
Yeah.
But made me incredibly angry in the fact that had I known that when I was 18 and when I went back to Hong Kong time, I might have gone to the orphanage because it was still standing and still operating then, right up until the sort of early 90s. I might have been able to find out something or picked up some breadcrumbs of who my biological parents were. Now I think that's going to be incredibly difficult. Yeah. If my biological parents are alive, then they are going to be well into their 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's a period of time in Hong Kong's history which I think they find very painful. So they don't really talk about the overseas adoptions that occurred during that time.
Yeah.
So it's something that made me really cross, and I wanted to make sure that people understood, whether they are prospective adoptive parents or parents who have adopted, that it's incredibly important, as difficult as it might be, and in some senses possibly painful as it might be for the adoptive parents, that you have to acknowledge where your child has come from, and that you have to give that child, that young adult, the opportunity to decide whether they want to trace roots, whether they want to find out more about their, you know, sort of their birth culture. I mean, during the 60s, learning Cantonese would have been was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
The internet wasn't around, etc. So foreign languages like that were only taught academically. So, you know, unless you knew somebody who was from Hong Kong or who was a native speaker, it just wasn't going to happen. But I think it's incredibly important that children from different cultures should almost, in some senses, be made to learn their native language up to a certain point. So maybe the time until they're 16, and then it's their decision whether they wish to go on to do that. Because the mere fact of me going back to Hong Kong, not being able to communicate, was kind of like really difficult, and I found it kind of both sad and angry at the same time. I'm a British East Asian, by British meaning that I don't speak Cantonese or Mandarin well, not very well, or hardly. English is my native language. British culture is what I was brought up in, and what I understand first and foremost. So I think it's really important that children that are adopted from other cultures are given every chance to actually be able to reconnect. When they get to adulthood, 18, then it should be up to them if they wish not to continue on that. But at least they have the basics. Mm. At least they have an understanding, a cultural understanding, a linguistic understanding, which I didn't, you know, sort of being completely culturally disenfranchised was yet another add-on to the fact that I was not white.
Yeah, I was going to say that's another layer, isn't it, on top of all the other. I mean, there's, you know, let's face it, there's layer upon layer upon layer here. But to add that, you know, that's especially when you're becoming a teenager and you want to, you know, I'm assuming teenager. I mean, you know, it could be earlier, it could be later. But, you know, to have that kind of that other layer when you think that, you know, that must.
I mean, it's difficult enough as it is, you know, sort of going through those teenage years when you are discovering yourself as an individual, as a, you know, sort of becoming an adult, and finding your place is difficult enough, I think, for many people, irrespective of their background. But you have those other kind of like challenges, and it is something that a lot of people don't recover from. Is that the right word? I'm not sure. But it's something that continues to dog a lot of transracial adoptees. I mean, as we know in the States, we've just seen, you know, adoptee, you know, sort of awareness day or coming up to the adoptive national adoptive
month.
That's month, but the way for, you know, sort of thinking about adoptees as a whole, we are four times more likely to commit suicide than any other group, which must say something. Now that we have an understanding of psychology, of growing up and the need to belong even though it's a human construct, you know, sort of race and identifies, it's still obviously an essential need for an individual and a human being to actually have that understanding of how they fit into their immediate family, immediate community, and therefore the wider community. So it's something that's necessary that we need to continue to understand and continue to help people who have been dislocated and disenfranchised in a way of actually finding a way back to being comfortable with themselves and not feigning the perennial outsider, which is, I think, a lot of adoptees still do. They, you know, they do feel that way, and it's reinforced by the way that adoption is used in entertainment. You know, the storylines about adoptees to be kind of like quite black and white, and the adoptee tends to be the one is at best distrustful. And I know people say it's only the entertainment, but that is another reinforcement of that story, you know, of expecting an adoptee to be perennially grateful and forever beholden to the people that have adopted them, in the same way that we, you know, one doesn't turn around and tell a naturally born child you have to be forever beholden to your parents. They grow up, they, you know, some families split apart, you have arguments, but if it happens and it's adoptee, that the way that that natural occurrence is looked upon is very different. And invariably the adoptee is singled out as the villain of the piece. And it's not as simple as that.
Can I just ask, I'm just going to take you back to the beginning when you told me about being an activist, and I wondered about that, and because it's quite clear, you know what you're talking about. That's, you know, whether it's from a personal perspective or whether it's from the kind of well-rounded thing. And, you know, I'm thinking about the American situation recently where there was a massive kind of a really, really great campaign to increase the awareness that American transracial adoptees didn't have a legal status in the US, isn't it? You know, where they could actually be removed at any time based on their backgrounds. So that activist side, and also, but the support for you, you know, having found throughout your adulthood all this information, and especially you know, this big file that you spoke of. I mean, that must, like, mind blown in that respect from my point of view, because I wouldn't have known anything about that either. But, you know, so where does the activism come from? And then on the other side of that, where do you get your support from to be able to support you? Or do you just have to plough through it on your own or with your, you know, 98 fellow foundlings to kind of find some peace with it all, if that's what I'm worth?
The activism comes from a need to, I think, ensure that other transracial adoptees, particularly sort of adoptees from East Asian countries, are aware that there are things that they can do if they are interested in finding out or trying to find out more where they come from. I mean, transracial adoptees are, as a group, are as diverse as any other group in British society. And just transracial adoptees and happen to have come from one or two orphanages in Hong Kong doesn't mean to say that we're all joined at the hip. As another transracial adoptee from the same group said that, you know, sort of it was nice to meet everyone else. In some senses, she has more in common with people who go cycling because that's her love. Than she did with transracial adoptees. I mean, it's like saying to somebody who's gay, just because you're gay, you must know everybody.
You must know everybody. Yeah, exactly.
You don't. You know, it's like any other group. We have our own diversity, and I suppose it was also, I'm singularly aware that in the UK, again, we are kind of really bad at standing up and shouting out. It's something I found in my professional career as a British East Asian. Until fairly recently, you know, sort of East Asians, the way that we were treated, we were portrayed and the storylines that were coming out on British media, TV and you know, film, theatre were chronically appalling, to for want of a better word. And it's this kind of, you know, sort of playing into the modern minority myth, and it is a myth. You know, China has got to be one of the most kind of volatile nations in terms of having revolutions and speaking out. So where this idea that, you know, sort of East Asians are kind of like silent and acquiescent, I don't know. So it's from a need to actually stand up and speak and actually say, it is okay. I mean, I've been very lucky. I had a period where I was under counselling. And it was a fluke. It was a fluke. I was incredibly lucky to be placed with a counsellor who basically turned round to me and said, you have permission to feel angry. You don't need, you don't have to feel grateful or beholden. These are not, you know, sort of abnormal feelings. They are not aberrant behaviors. It's human. And you have, you know, and it's something that you have to obviously go through and recognize in order to deal with it. So I was incredibly lucky that this particular counselor recognized what I was going through. That's not the case for many other adoptees and transracial adoptees who end up in counselling. You know, they are not served very, very well, I don't think. I think it's really important that whilst we would all like to think that, you know, sort of adoptions, whether they're international or national, end up, you know, sort of being the wonderful story that they are, that a lot of the times is not the case. You know, you are possibly dealing, obviously, with older adoptees, with children that remember a previous life, that have, may have had challenges, emotional situations that have been thrust onto them, which will make them behave in certain ways. And as much as we would like to think that love is enough, it's not. Absolutely, there has to be unconditional love there to start with, but that is not, that's just the start.
Yeah.
You know, if taking on somebody that has had a previous life, even if they're at a babe at arms, that is something that has to be dealt with by everybody that's concerned within, you know, sort of the new family. And very often it's something which is not talked about or is dismissed, or it's still thought, you know, sort of cut ties and we'll start again, a fresh beginning is the best. And the expectation that adoptees have to, adoptive parents have to know all the answers. Well, you don't, you can't. The most important thing is that you are there for your child and that your child is whole and has a may have had a complete other life before that child even came into your family. And that's a difficult one, you know, because we're human beings and it sometimes hurts. I suspect, you know, if you have an adopted child who's asking questions about sort of their birth parents, but quite a lot of the adopted parents that run into challenges is because they can't let go of their ego. Is that the right word?
Maybe.
and it's difficult because in some senses you can mistake that as reflecting ill on you that you haven't done enough as an adoptive parent. But that's not the case. I mean, you know, it's like any child that's growing up, they will ask questions. They ask difficult questions. They ask the questions that most often we don't know how to respond to. We don't know how to answer them, even if we do have the answers.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of, you don't get a manual when you become a parent, however you become a parent.
That,
you don't.
Yeah.
You just have to figure that out for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. And so it is difficult, but I think we very often forget that children can understand a lot more than we give them credit for. And being untruthful about things. I mean, my situation was very much of its time. I mean, yes, being cold and harsh, I was lied to an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, times being what they were, those parents that adopted weren't given any training at all.
Yeah.
You know, it was, they did the financial checks, they made sure that they were of good standing, which was one of the conditions during that period, and, you know, hey presto, they were adopting a child from Hong Kong. Yeah. So you have to weigh those things up. But what angers me the most is, in this day and age, when we know all that we do about child development, we know all that we do about how separation from mothers and what happens to children that are separated, even young babies, and yet we still, some of us, don't want to actually acknowledge that that is a factor, that that can actually present challenges, and they are slow burns. They are things that kind of like develop slowly as the child develops.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something that needs to be recognized more than it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also society needs to kind of rethink the language and the way that they view people who are adopted, and how they treat them subconsciously. I think, you know, sort of, it's, there is still that kind of like stigma, which surprises me. You know, sort of, we should be a lot further along that trail of reforming the adoption sort of industry and in general how children are fostered and adopted. I think we lag far behind, which is quite concerning, because at the end of the day, it impacts on the child, obviously, and our ability to basically give children the support that they need, whether that be through fostering, adoption, or better state provided, you know, sort of in childcare, you know, sort of residential childcare. I think it's still pretty, hasn't changed that much since the 60s. I mean, there have been developments, but I think a lot more should be done within those institutions that look after, especially, you know, sort of the younger children.
Yeah.
And indeed, the way that we kind of like society here views older children in care. You get to 18 and then basically that's it.
Yeah.
Of the system, which is ridiculous and shouldn't really happen, but it does.
Yeah. Can I draw you in on one last thing before we wrap up? And that's about just what you said there, really. Do you think it's more of a financial thing that we don't do that, or do you think it's that there's not the want within the powers that be to do that, or where do you think that sits at the moment from your point of view?
But I think it's both, and now in this current time it will be predominantly fiscal, obviously. But I think there's been, you know, a lack of investment, a lack of support through numerous governments of variety of colours since, like, I would say the 80s, where they have not addressed the problems and the challenges that face childcare and social services. And if the will doesn't come from the top, then, you know, sort of think it's very difficult to change how those institutions work. And they desperately need changing. They desperately need investment, you know, social services departments. I mean, I don't know how they manage to cope with the workloads that they have.
Mm.
You know, I'm surprised that we don't have more awful cases, you know, of abuse than we do have. And every time it happens, it is, this should be the last time, never again. Yeah. But governments continue to shave back the budgets that are available for these departments that do vital services.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a whole heap of things, you know, sort of the lack of inter-departments and inter, you know, sort of agency collaborations where one, you know, sort of the police services will do one thing and social services aren't aware of that. I mean, it's because it's understaffed that both of those agencies are understaffed, undermanned, underpaid, you know, sort of under-resourced.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like everything, you know, sort of you have to invest in it. We have to. Otherwise, we end up in a situation like we're in at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we'll never move on from it, you know, if it's just not done.
Precisely.
Yeah. So, Lucy, just before we go then, is there anything else? Because I'm not one for going off before you get the chance to say anything else that you want to say. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we finish up today?
No, but thank you for having me. And if people want to connect to me, I'm on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find me at Lucy Sheen, capital L, capital S.
Yeah.
So just give me a nudge. I will respond as quickly as I can.
Yeah.
No, I have nothing else to say. Cool.
Well, we will link your Twitter name on the blurb when we send this out. You've really kind of given me a lot of food for thought. It's not something that I sit and ponder of an evening, do you know what I mean? So it's and I think there's a lot of crossovers between what you've been saying in terms of just the kind of international aspect, but also, you know, I think back years ago when I was a child, and you know, my distant, and when I say distant, they weren't even related, aunt and uncle, they adopted two children from Hong Kong as well in the 80s. And it never kind of, you know, nothing clicked with me about that, because obviously I was a child, and, you know, that was kind of my upbringing was obviously different to some people. But just thinking how they've got on, I don't, you know, it's just really made me think a lot about kind of that aspect, because, you know, obviously adoption is kind of what we live and breathe, but actually there's so many different layers dependent on the kind of background. So thank you so much for that, and I'm sure anybody who's listening who's interested will hopefully feel the same about it and think about things that, you know, you've kind of raised. So thank you for your time, I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.